This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We will start today with an update on the latest news with the election fraud in the United States from Andrew.
On Wednesday, President Trump delivered what he said could be the most important speech he's ever given. It was a 46-minute speech on election fraud, and he opened by noting that, as president, I have no higher duty than to defend the laws of the Constitution of the United States. That's why I am determined to protect our election system, which is now under coordinated assault and siege. And now he had this was actually like an audio-visual presentation where he had posters and things like that, but he really focused in on two big areas of election fraud. I mean, there's a lot of different types of election fraud, but he kept this focused on mail-in ballots and electronic voting. Just noting what people should have known for years, and that mail-in ballots are extremely susceptible to fraud. They know they've had problems with them for fraud in the big cities like Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee and Atlanta for years. But obviously with this election, just because they sent out so many due to the COVID lockdowns, that problem is just orders of magnitude greater. I think we have someone in the office here who received 3 mail-in ballots to his house address because I guess people had lived there before. So just to be safe, they sent one to him and they sent one to the previous resident and they sent one to the previous resident before that, even though he hadn't requested one, and obviously neither of the previous residents who didn't live in that house either. So you can say you don't have to do that too many times before there's like way more ballots than people. And in Trump's President Trump's presentation, I mean, he showed just the huge what he called dumps, where you'll just look and then there's all of a sudden this enormous spike in the graph of a certain county where you're like, oh yeah, we've just got like several thousand ballots all at once, 100% for Joe Biden,
right?
That it takes a long time obviously to go through all those and see what's legitimate or not, but it's really suspicious when you've just got, like I said, yeah, people receiving three ballots when they didn't request any, and then huge dumps of ballots just coming in at strategic counties, all in for Biden. And it's taken the Trump's legal team and the Justice Department just a ton of effort to go through all these different scenarios where you're getting just dumps and dumps of ballots.
Yeah, this is all happening on such a compressed time frame, and there are hundreds of people who are coming forward and saying that they saw irregularities, they witnessed things that shouldn't have been going on, they witnessed crimes taking place right before their eyes. Now you have this video that's coming out of suitcases full of ballots being pulled out from underneath tables after everyone is evacuated from a facility to stop counting. The evidence continues to pile up. And as Stephen Fleury has been bringing out on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, what would it take before the media would begin to show any kind of curiosity or concern about what's going on? Because the narrative continues to be there is no evidence. And now the clock is ticking. What do you think is going to happen here with just how quickly this could get to the point where states are certifying, the Electoral College meets in 10 days? What happens going forward?
No, you're right. You would think you'd be much more concerned, like President Trump made in his part in defending the laws of the Constitution. I mean, the media claims is that well, if it's not enough to overturn the election, it doesn't matter. And it's like, says, well, it might be enough to overturn the election. And even if it didn't, you'd think that you'd just be concerned about trying to expose whatever corruption did happen so you don't have these types of problems in the future. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, President Trump also threw a spotlight on Dominion voting as well. That's the electronic voting that at least Sidney Powell's claimed has been weighted, that you could, like, one vote for Biden in their algorithms actually counts for more than one vote. I mean, they're still waiting for some of the proof on that, but I've done some research into just the structure of how Dominion's set up, and that thing is a mess with, like, a holding account here and a holding account there and an investment from a Chinese investor here, and just trying to map that thing out, where he mentioned in the speech that, like, you really just need to go back to paper so people can understand what's going on. But like you said, just this compressed time frame makes it hard, because, I mean, the Electoral College meets in 10 days. And so what President Trump's, I think what is hoping will happen is that they'll be able to expose enough fraud in the next 10 days that, either state legislatures will send a different set of electors to the Electoral College if they expose that the vote was rigged. Or if there's elections can't, if there's state legislators aren't confident enough in their results, either don't send electors or have those electors throw a ballot for a third candidate and then let a convention of the states decide it. There's even some Republicans are already preparing kind of a backup plan to buy them a little more time too, and that even though the Electoral College meets on December 14th, Congress doesn't certify the results till January 6th. So, I mean, there is a potential that that's never been done before, but even if the Electoral College votes for one way and you still have evidence of mass fraud emerge after that you could have Congress step in and refuse to certify the result because it was made using fraudulent information.
Well, we are on the edge of our seats. This is just an incredibly dramatic story that is unfolding in America, and we do want to direct you to that article that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, wrote, Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President, and also keep up with Stephen Flory on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as he focuses on this. We see this unfold, and it is, as Andrew said, going to happen. It seems, by all appearances, that this will all have to be resolved here within the next few weeks. So we will keep our eyes very closely on what is happening there. Thank you very much for that story, Andrew. As Joe Biden prepares to take over as America's president, one of his objectives is to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. Well, Iran made a move this week that dampens those hopes. In fact, it's pretty close to a declaration of war. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, the Biden administration has definitely showcased to the world their desire to come back to the not just the negotiating table, but actually entrench itself within a nuclear deal again. And Iran obviously knows that, and so they are trying to up the ante, and they did so this past week with two new laws that they've introduced. And these are laws that were passed through the actual parliament, and then they were confirmed by the Guardian Council, so these are definite laws that are going to take effect. This is not just bluster from Iran. And two parts for these laws. The first law says that Iran is to start enriching its uranium from 5% that it's at right now, which is already above the legal percentage of purity by the nuclear deal, up to 20%. And so and that is on the way towards weapons grade, and weapons grade would be 90% enriched uranium, but you can't get it's not the same speed that it takes to get to 5%, to get to 20, to get to 90. Basically, once they get to 20, it's only a couple of weeks before they would get to 90% enriched uranium, should they choose to go there.
So there would be no reason to go to 20 other than nuclear weapons production.
Right. Other than nuclear weapons production, this is a declaration that they are using nuclear blackmail once again to try and get the Obama administration, get the Biden administration, incoming as they see it, to withdraw, or at least to, let's say, to withdraw the sanctions on them, to reinstate them with all the money, or at least give them access to the international markets once again. And then the other thing that they want most probably is damages, damages for the Trump administration's lack of finances that they've received because Trump has put on them so many sanctions. So they're probably going to ask a lot from the Biden administration coming in, and this has already started, obviously. So that's flaw number one. The second
Just to jump in for a second, it is really interesting, one more scenario that's playing out because of the way that the U.S. election is unfolding, people expecting a Biden administration to come in, showing their true colors. We're seeing this so many ways domestically within the United States, but even internationally, we're seeing actors acting out in ways that they would not if they knew that a Trump administration was going to be in for a second term. Fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you, liberal left-wing media, for pushing this narrative that Biden has already won, or else Iran would not be exposing itself to the degree that it is. No one can come out and say now that Iran desires a peaceful nuclear program. They are exposing themselves that they are after a bomb, and if you don't give us what we want, we are going to push towards it. And what this is looking like is they're going to push towards it no matter what. They're going to ask, before they would even halt what they're doing, they're going to ask the Biden administration, as they would see it, for lots and lots of money. And so, I mean, Iran is exposing themselves through these moves, and they wouldn't have done so had they thought President Trump was going to come in. They wouldn't have dared showcase their hand like this.
Right.
The second law that was passed actually says that if by February the Biden administration, as they see it, does not let go of all the sanctions on us, we are going to bar entry to Iran from weapons inspectors, IAEA weapons inspectors, those that are meant to be guaranteeing or at least safeguarding what Iran is doing. Basically saying all the inspectors are gone unless you come back to the negotiating table unless you give us exactly what we want. And so, you know, these weapons inspectors, or the, let's say, the IAEA inspectors, nuclear inspectors, they're already not able to see everything they want to see. And Ross Grossi, the head of the IAEA, just came out and said last week that we cannot trust anything Iran says, you know, with its nuclear program. So you need us there on the ground. And part two of this law is not IAEA, you're getting out. No inspectors unless we get a lot of money from the United States.
Now, reports basically say that this is Iran's retribution. This is its response to the assassination of their top nuclear scientist that took place last week. There are others who are looking at this and saying, if that's the case, they're digging their own grave. It's an interesting play. I mean, it does show just what Iran is all about, the fact that they're coming out this boldly with these kinds of moves. What do you think may go forward, especially knowing what we know about, the way the situation in America is going to play out?
Yeah, well, I think what this has done is exposing Iran to the entire world of what their game plan is. I do think that they've got no reason not to plow ahead with it's only going to take them a few more weeks until they get to 20% from 5%. They have the centrifuges up and running, that they can do this. And so I expect them to push towards this. They are going to increase the leverage on the Biden administration as much as possible before he comes into office. And so when he doesn't come into office, and when Trump continues as president of the United States, then Iran is further exposed to everyone. And hopefully the Europeans come around to see and actually act on the new knowledge of what Iran has showcased before the world. Iran could also always be in the before the nuclear deal was negotiated, it could say to the world, it's only for peaceful purposes. The nuclear deal did not constrain Iran to show what they were doing with their nuclear program and nuclear of the past. That's what everyone wanted. Come clean. But the nuclear deal said, don't worry, we know what you were up to, but don't worry, you don't have to come clean on your nuclear ambitions that you wanted from the past. Iran right now is admitting to their nuclear ambitions, current nuclear ambitions. Because what we expect in biblical prophecy terms is for the Europeans to finally become the ones that recognize that Iran's desire is to get a bomb. Now, the European leaders probably already know this, but they didn't have they weren't pushed to publicly acknowledge that that was Iran's goal by their populations, because there was plausible deniability from the Iranian regime. That is gone now. And so European populations, you would think, are going to now say to their leaders, what gives? Why in the world are we for a nuclear deal with Iran when they do want a nuclear weapon? And biblical prophecy says again that it's going to be Europe that it actually constrains Iran in the long run. But obviously the Trump administration is having a constraining effect on Iran right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does certainly vindicate the tougher approach that Donald Trump has taken, watching what Iran is doing now, as many people as want to brand him as a warmonger and so on. The tougher stance definitely tends to keep the warmongering at bay. So where would you send people for more information if they want more on the prophecy that you were describing?
Well, I think for starters, they could just read what I wrote this past week, Chief Architect of Iran's Nuclear Weapons Program Assassinated, because it goes in towards the end about this dilemma we're facing right now with the Biden administration potentially coming in as Iran would see it, and why Iran is acting in the way that it is.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Iran is not the only nation pushing toward war. Russia has America's Navy personnel quite concerned over the way that it is rapidly militarizing the Arctic. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this came up on Wednesday when the Secretary of the U.S. Navy, Mr. Kenneth Braithwaite, was addressing the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he gave basically an update about all that Russia has accomplished in the Arctic over the last several months. And I think it's just very sobering to consider just how much Russia has accomplished there. So we know that back in the Cold War era, the Soviet Union did their best to militarize the Arctic, and their achievements there were significant, but the area was still largely inaccessible because of ice and the technological limitations of the time. But now we have a situation where the sea ice is not as ubiquitous or as thick as it long was, and the technology has simultaneously improved a great deal, especially with the icebreaker ships that Russia has invested so much into. And so Braithwaite explained that Russia is taking advantage of all these changing circumstances, apparently a lot more ambitiously than other Arctic nations. And so they're rebuilding the presence that they had there during the Soviet era, and they're even going beyond it. And Russia right now has 10 operational airports or airfields, with 6 more under construction. They have at least 6 ports or other naval facilities, and then 6 multi-purpose military bases that are either completed or very close to it, and then a number of other smaller kind of support facilities. So it is a formidable presence, and it's mostly concentrated around Murmansk Oblast, but really it's spreading right now along the whole coast there. And part of Braithwaite's address said, quote, "Russia has remilitarized the Arctic, and it should be an alarm to all Americans, as an Arctic nation, that we should have a more formidable presence to ensure rule of law and freedom of the seas in that part of the world." And then Alaskan Senator Dan Sullivan also spoke at this session, which, you know, that makes sense since Alaska is where America has its Arctic territory. And Sullivan said that the Russians are using that expanding military footprint to increasingly bully mostly civilians at this point from other nations. He said, "Russia has accelerated its provocative encounters, harassing American fishing vessels in U.S. waters and sending bombers toward Alaska's shores." So, you know, the Russians are not just militarizing the region, but they are using their growing firepower there and turning this historically low-tension area into yet another zone of competition and conflict.
I have two questions. One is, maybe you could just talk about the reasons why Russia would be interested in militarizing the Arctic and what it is that they're seeking up there, whether it's resources or strategic advantage. Second, why would they be so openly provoking the United States fishing vessels and American presence in Alaska?
Sure, yeah. Well, for the first one, resources is a huge part of it. Russian President Vladimir Putin actually visited the Arctic last year, and he said, quote, "Natural resources, which are of paramount importance for the Russian economy, are concentrated in this region." And he talked about how important it was for Russia to tap into all that. And the U.S. Geological Survey did publish an estimate recently that confirms what Putin said. It talked about the Arctic holding 30% of the world's undiscovered natural gas, that's their estimate, and 13% of the world's undiscovered or untapped oil. So huge, you know, amounts of energy wealth. And then the Arctic is also known to hold vast troves of gold, platinum, and zinc. Other minerals like that, so just trillions of dollars worth of resources. And that's a big part of the reason why Russia is determined to dominate it and to keep others out. There's also the Northern Sea Route. You mentioned strategic reasons. And Russia would love to not just be able to tap into all those Arctic resources, but be able to ship them out of the Arctic and to markets around the world more efficiently. And the Northern Sea Route is a big part of that. Most of these military installations are along that route that would let Russia ship from basically the Kara Sea near the border there on the west coast, and then across to the Bering Strait, you know, all the way across down through the Bering Strait, which Russia and Alaska border there. So that would shave an enormous amount of time, up to 15 days off of a lot of oil shipments from Russia to China, mm-hmm. the Arctic to China, which in the world of shipping, that's just a massive amount of time.
Mm-hmm. And Russia actually has quite a bit of ice-cutting technology and resources that it's able to use to... It really is a leader in the technology required to make those kinds of voyages.
That's right, yes. The ice-breaking fleet that Russia has is head and shoulders above that of America or Canada or any of the other Arctic nations, and that's a big part of the reason why they're able to do this. And then you had also asked about why they're harassing U.S. fishermen, and mostly it's just about making a statement. They want to stake their claim. These are our waters. These are our resources. Even if you're on an internationally neutral side of it, we don't like that, and they just want to assert their dominance more and more.
So you have to view this in the context of the aggressive moves that Russia is making, generally speaking, that they do have a confidence, and as we've mentioned in previous segments, they're very good at marshaling their resources to maximum effect. This definitely looks like another instance where you kind of see what Russia is really about and just how good they are at leveraging what they have to use.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it shows that, you know, this is not the Russia that it was during the 90s or even the early 2000s. Back in 2008, when Russia invaded the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury at that time said that that was a watershed moment. He said that it just marked a turning point in global affairs, and he said it signaled what he called a dangerous new era for the world, you know, an era in which Russia is more opportunistic, more aggressive, more intent on leveraging its power, as you said. And Mr. Fleury said that his analysis in that article was built on Bible prophecies in Daniel 11 and Revelation 9 and also Joel chapter 2. And, you know, now we have 12 years to look back on since Mr. Fleury wrote that article. And it's clear that that Russian invasion of Georgia truly was a watershed moment. You know, since then, Russia has invaded Ukraine. It's pushed against U.S. power in the Middle East. It's partnered up with China to really push against the global peace in a number of ways. It's built a naval base in Sudan. It's established a military presence in the South Caucasus, which we spoke about just a couple of weeks back. And then with this story today, we see that Russia has also made some astounding gains in militarizing the Arctic. So, you know, Putin is clearly reviving Russia's power. And as Mr. Fleury wrote, this is one of the big reasons why mankind is now in a dangerous new era.
Well, we will link to that article, Russia's Attack Signals a Dangerous New Era, in the show notes for today's program. And Jeremiah is also working on an article on this subject that will appear on the website at thetrumpet.com next week. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Over to Germany now, where growing dissatisfaction with the political system there is manifesting in an especially troubling form. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this week, the German Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, announced the banning of a particularly disturbing right-wing extremist group. It's called Sturmbrigade 44. This banning came after a series of raids across three different German states that took place earlier in the week. And it's also known as Wolf's Brigade 44. But that 44 is code. It's like D is the fourth letter of the alphabet, so it's code for Division Derlwanger, which is refers to an SS division in World War II led by someone called Oskar Derlwanger, which was known for being a particularly sadistic war criminal. You know, this is kind of the worst of the SS, and they're naming themselves after this, the most cruel, the most sadistic of all the different SS groups. And they're saying, well, this is the type of history that we need to revive and bring back. And there's been history with this group before. For example, in 2008, there were a bag of weapons and a T-shirt with the group's name that was found left on a train. And a bag of weapons, a T-shirt, and then they carried out more raids last year. Now they've officially outlawed them, and that will allow the government to do much more to try and track down and close down this group. But it's a particularly disturbing group to have exist at all.
Right. You could look at this as a story of Germany trying to purge these elements from its midst, but really... knowing what we know about Germany and the role that it's going to play in prophecy in the future, you have to look at this more in terms of just the fact that you have these groups, that there is such a widespread. This is certainly not the only group like this that the government has tried to crack down on. Existing in Germany, sympathies for, as you said, the very worst of the elements of German history.
That's right. And one of the most disturbing aspects of this, and Joshua Michels brings this out in an article we'll have up on our website on Monday, is that there are some indications that the police have turned a blind eye to this group and other far right groups, that there are people, fine, who may not be as extreme, but they're willing to tolerate and even cover up for these kind of groups within the German police and these organizations that are meant to be cracking down on them. He talks about in that article how there were raids in three states on this group. There were actually meant to be raids in more states, but a number of courts in these other states blocked the raids and said, well, that we don't recognize a sufficient basis for a search warrant. One of the courts that blocked it is the Halle Administrative Court, which just last year they had a shooting in this town. And there's questions being asked about even how closely they're investigating that shooting and the far-right extremist. And whether even there was some police turning the blind eye to that. And you know, with that, that is more people asking questions than definitive proof. But they're asking questions because there is a track record here that goes back decades of police turning a blind eye, security turning a blind eye. The Germany's intelligence, this kind of internal secret service, has a lot of very pointed questions to answer, which they've been ignoring, where it does look like they're even potentially funding far-right groups. So it's not just the groups themselves, though. Those groups themselves are a worrying symptom, but then it's there's potential of cover-up or authorities working with these groups. And of course, there's the subject that we've discussed on and off throughout this whole year of many of these different groups working their way into the German military, and there being especially the elite parts of the German military being a hotbed of sympathy for these different extremist groups.
And I guess the other side of it, and is even more broad, that is the effect that the sympathies for these groups are having on the political scene, where you have parties in Germany that are becoming increasingly popular, who do express at least some degree of alignment with the thinking behind some of these groups. That is very different than the kind of centrist and very strongly anti-Nazi rhetoric that has dominated the German political scene for a long time. There's a lot of frustration with immigration and other issues that these groups tend to identify with.
Right. I think that's a fascinating story that I want to get a bit more into over the next few weeks, and I have a chance to write on it, where you've got this Alternative for Deutschland group in Germany that, like you were talking about, it's way outside the mainstream. Some of its leaders have basically sounded almost neo-Nazi, or not even almost neo-Nazi, just outright neo-Nazi, and talking and praising some of those, saying that, well, we need to celebrate the achievements of Germany's soldiers in World War One and World War Two, and calling for Holocaust memorials to be torn down and this kind of thing. But at the same time, if you disagree with the coronavirus lockdown, or if you disagree with migrants flooding into Germany, both of which I think are very reasonable policies to disagree with, the Alternative for Deutschland is about your only option. There's not really much difference between all the other German parties when it comes to some of these big, important questions. They're the only ones that are saying, well, you know, handing over all of our freedom over a virus that 99 point whatever people survive might not be the best idea. And so you're seeing a lot of people getting pushed towards some of these extremist groups, and that's a dangerous trend too.
Well, do keep your eye on the website for that article by Josue Michels, Haunted by Far Right Crimes. It's very important because this gives you a picture of what's going on in Germany that is extremely concerning and very consistent with what Bible prophecy tells us to expect out of this country.
Yeah, and another article that we have that will give you a breakdown of all of that prophecy is an article called "The Nazi Underground Revealed," and that, you know, this was something that Herbert W. Armstrong, the founder of the Plain Truth magazine, our predecessor, he was incredibly specific about some of these far-right views going underground within Germany. He made a lot of specific statements, and they have been proven true. So that article, the Nazi Underground Revealed, goes through those statements, goes through why he made them based on Bible prophecy, and just gives you a ton of evidence where it just shows how prescient these forecasts and this Bible prophecy is.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a move this week from Bill Barr that could further expose some of the corruption in America's deep state. We'll also look at troubling news from Hong Kong, a fascinating development in Lebanon, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has said that one of the most important outcomes of the Trump presidency is the exposure of corruption and wrongdoing on the part of the previous administration. This past week, the U.S. Attorney General made a move that could yield significant results toward that end. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
On Tuesday, U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr appointed U.S. Attorney John Durham as a special counsel. Now, the special counsel position, that's the same position Robert Mueller had when he did his big, long, several-month investigation into the Trump administration. And in many ways, special counsel Durham is going to be like the anti-Mueller. In that he's investigating the investigators, or he's basically investigating the corruption of the people behind that Russia collusion hoax. And the fact that he did it this week is significant. I know President Trump's been kind of a little miffed that it's Durham's been looking at this so long and hasn't produced anything yet. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they appointed him special counsel this week does indicate that the media is wrong in claiming that Durham hasn't found anything, and that this isn't like the Mueller investigation where they made you special counsel and said, go see if you can find anything. He's been looking into this for a long time. And so if he hadn't found anything, they'd let it go. If they're like, oh, well, we're going to like up your position to special counsel, is a good indication that he's got some stuff, got some work that he's already accomplished that needs finishing. And then in the eyes of Bill Barr and some of those who are taking the prospect of a Biden presidency seriously, this also makes Durham harder to get rid of The president can fire a special counsel, but as Trump found out with Robert Mueller, it looks a little suspicious. So once he's to that position, you kind of have to just let him finish his work. It also makes it harder for some of the people that were involved in the Russia collusion hoax to be given positions without looking too suspicious in a suspected Biden administration, where, for example, both Joe Biden and Sally Yates were in the January 5th meeting we've talked about on this program a lot of times before, where the Barack Obama was meeting with his security chiefs to strategize how to investigate Donald Trump after he became president. Now, Biden said that if he, when he comes into his office, he wants to give Sally Yates a important position in the Justice Department. Now, even Biden's admitted, he's like, well, she'll have to recuse herself from the Durham investigation because that she's the one being investigated. It's, like I said, really suspicious to have the department, the department involved in the investigation of yourself.
Right.
So it's, but we'll put in the show notes the hidden message behind the Horowitz report from our editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry that really goes through the origins of what John Durham's investigating, the Hillary Clinton campaign paying this former British agent to collect rumors and innuendo from alleged contacts he had in Russia and put together this dossier, this fake dossier that you could use to investigate the Trump administration, which the Horowitz report's already out revealed much of the corruption in that document, and now they're upping John Durham's position to reveal even more of it. But it does really tie directly in with that that prophecy we talk so much about in 2 Kings 14 about God seeing the affliction of Israel and that it was bitter, and then giving them a savior, like a political savior, to expose all that corruption, because this is stuff that we would have never found out about if President Trump wasn't elected. And now, like I said, even the fact that people are giving John Durham this elevated position so late in the game shows that they're concerned that we're not going to find out more under a Biden administration, and trying to do whatever they can to give people the positions they need to continue that work.
Well, we will remain optimistic, given all that Gerald Flurry has said about that, and how important the exposure of all of this corruption is. It's remarkable how long this has been going on with so little to show for it. And as we've been hearing about recently, just the fact that no one has been in prison to this point. That's not to say it won't happen, but we will definitely keep our eyes on that. And do check out that article from Gerald Flurry, The Hidden Message of the Horowitz Report. Thank you for that, Andrew. China's authoritarian takeover of Hong Kong advances this week with the imprisonment of prominent advocates of democracy. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we've been following the saga of China's takeover of Hong Kong closely over the last several years, and it really was a grim milestone that the Chinese crossed on Wednesday by imprisoning a 24-year-old man named Joshua Wong. He's now serving a 13-month sentence, and so far it has been in solitary confinement. And Joshua Wong's crime was protesting against China's encroachment on Hong Kong. So over the last couple of years, China has been tightening its grip on the city, systematically just, you know, dismantling its democracy. And Wong had for years been going out into the streets and protesting against this unlawful Chinese behavior, along with great numbers of other Hong Kongers. The protesters' numbers even got up to 2 million at one point in the summer of 2019. And, you know, considering that the whole territory only has about 7 million people, that's just enormous. So Wong definitely was not alone, but he had become sort of a face for that pro-democracy movement, and he was imprisoned for it. He's been able to get some messages out through his lawyer about just how tough the solitary confinement has been. Even just a few days in, he called that a prison within a prison. And then two others, a 23-year-old woman and a 26-year-old man, were also sentenced the same day to 10 months and 7 months. But for all three of these people, they have several other charges waiting for them that they haven't yet been sentenced for. So they'll be in there far longer than 13 months, 7 months, 10 months. They're in there now just for the first of many charges, and it's actually hard to say if or when they will ever be free. So, you know, there has been a lot of talk about China's new powers to arrest and imprison Hong Kongers since they passed new national security laws back in June of this year. And now we're getting a clear picture of what life in Hong Kong has become under those laws. You know, it's only a handful of people now, but I think these will be the first of many unless the Hong Kongers learn to behave like the people in the mainland of China, which is to fully submit to every wish and whim of the Communist Party. But overall, it was just a very dark week for democracy.
Remind us of the history of Hong Kong and why this crackdown is particularly alarming, and just what this tells us in terms of China's future, prophetically speaking.
Sure, yeah. When you look at the protest movement in Hong Kong, it is crucial to remember that history. You know, it was a British colony starting in the mid-1800s, and then in 1997, China convinced Britain to hand it over to Chinese control, and the terms of that handover treaty included a very clear clause that China agreed to. And that clause said that for at least 50 years, China would let Hong Kong have a high degree of autonomy and freedom, quite unlike the rest of China. But, you know, China has been just flagrantly violating that treaty, especially in the last 6 years or so. And that's why protesters like Joshua Wong and these other two were going out into the streets. Their message was, remember the treaty that you signed. Remember the promise that you made, you know, to let Hong Kong have freedoms. And China's new security laws really are unlawful because they violate that treaty. But China has absolutely no interest in abiding by that treaty anymore. And really, who is going to force them to do it? But you mentioned the prophecy, and that is just a very important part of this whole development to keep an eye on. For decades, America and British leadership were the main stabilizers of the world. They were really the main powers, and they did advance civilization for many peoples and nations. That may be more evident in Hong Kong than just about anywhere else. But that Anglo-American era is now ending. And the ending of that era was foretold in Bible prophecy. Luke chapter 21 talks about a new era coming in. In that passage, it's called the times of the Gentiles. It's basically a time when some nations besides the U.S. and Britain would grow powerful and become the main, you know, global hegemons. And we have an article called Hong Kong, the End of Freedom Begins that, it goes through that prophecy in Luke in a good bit of detail, and it shows how the situation in Hong Kong is a significant part of the fulfillment of that. And it also shows that as sobering as the onset of this new global era is, it's also tied into the most hope-filled event in history. So, you know, when we think about Joshua Wong and the others who are imprisoned right now, that can be just heartbreaking to think about. But there is a tremendous amount of hope there, too, some astounding silver lining that is crucial to keep in mind.
Hong Kong, the End of Freedom Begins is the name of the article that we'll put in the show notes. Go check that out. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We've been closely tracking events in Lebanon, watching the downfall of the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. More evidence of this prophetically significant trend emerged this week. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, a really interesting story was put forward this week from a Kuwaiti newspaper on Wednesday that said that the Hezbollah secretary general that has lived in southern Lebanon somewhere in a bunker hiding from Israeli assassins for a long time, he is actually out of the country or about to leave the country and go and stay in Iran for an indefinite period of time. There have been reports that were intercepted between the IRGC, which is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that operates out of Iran. So this is Iran's expeditionary force that then is over the top of all of its proxies, be it Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Houthis or Iraqi Shiites. You've got the IRGC at the top, and then Hezbollah would be underneath that. And so this is an interesting story because it shows that the Hezbollah leader does not feel it's safe any longer for himself to be in southern Lebanon. Of course, it doesn't seem like there's a safe place for such high-level terrorists in Iran either, given that there's been two high-level assassinations of terrorists in Iran, including the Fakhrizadeh, the scientist, last week,
right.
In the past month. And so, but nevertheless, it is really interesting to see that Hezbollah's own leader feels like it is better now and more safe for him to retreat back to Iran. Now, if you're a Hezbollah fighter inside Lebanon, and you have already spilled your blood, 4,000 Hezbollah fighters have died inside Syria, been sent across the border to fight for Iran and Bashar al-Assad. Morale is already very low. You're already getting half the amount of pay that you were getting 10 years ago inside being a Hezbollah fighter. So morale is so low already. And then to see your captain flee the ship, doesn't really encourage Hezbollah fighters to stand up and fight going forward.
Yeah, a really good point. You could see where this would definitely deflate the troops. An interesting article in National Interest talking about just how, I guess, really kind of this specific thing, that there are a whole lot of the ground troops that they're not hardcore ideologues. It's not like they're on board with all of the ideas that motivate and drive Hezbollah. There really are a lot of them that are there for the money, and their motivation is just evaporating as quickly as it possibly could.
Right. Yeah, this article written by Michael Rubin, who's been around a long time, it was written from Lebanon, from southern Lebanon in a Hezbollah stronghold, and he was talking to these Hezbollah people, and they're not just terrorists. They are a political party as well. And so he's getting in there and talking to those forces that have fought on behalf of the Lebanese, as they would see it. They see themselves as a resistance against Israel for all Lebanese. And he was talking to them, and it seems from at least his reporting that you do have the different types of Shiite fighters, Hezbollah fighters, those that are the true ideologues that would be upset by Nasrallah leaving, those that have fought for Hezbollah because they saw itself as the defense against Israel. But now that's shown to be not true, since they've been sent over the border to fight inside Syria. They've just been shown to be an Iranian proxy, nothing about Lebanon. And then you have the others that were in for the money, and that's not there anymore. And so there is a weakening of morale amongst Hezbollah, that their purpose has been eroded. Just one quote. He says in the end here, simply put, as Hezbollah becomes a shell of its former self, locals are losing their fear. He's talking about those people that are willing now to come out inside inside Lebanon, the Lebanese public, and former Hezbollah fighters, to actually come out and stand against Hezbollah, to speak against Hezbollah. There used to be a fear of doing that in Lebanon. That no longer exists. Then he says there is a certain irony that in Washington, D.C., Democrats loudly and Republicans a bit more softly suggest that the maximum pressure campaign against Iran to be a failure. But in the heart of Hezbollah country, residents tell a different story. Hezbollah is cash poor, resented, and has lost its luster. Mm-hmm. So the Trump administration's plan to hit Iran hard has hit Hezbollah hard, and Hezbollah is having trouble maintaining its morale and its ranks because of that in southern Lebanon.
I'd say it wasn't too long ago that a forecast that Hezbollah would lose its foothold in Lebanon was pretty contrary to what the facts looked like. But this is what the Trump has been saying for years based on prophecies in the Bible about Lebanon. And we really are seeing this materialize dramatically ever since this past summer with that blast in Beirut. You wrote about that at the time. But this trend really has accelerated in the months since that time.
Yeah, it certainly has. And we were standing alone for years saying that Hezbollah is going to lose out in Lebanon, Iran's power. And that was even as Iran and Hezbollah were getting more powerful.
Right.
But as we headlined in our October 2020 edition of The Trumpet, our editor-in-chief, wrote an article why we told you to watch Lebanon, because we expected this very thing, for Hezbollah to weaken its power base there in southern Lebanon and Lebanon as a whole, and for Iran to find itself on the outside looking in, no longer being the kingmaker and the decision maker in Lebanon, and that it, we are moving towards the fulfillment of that prophecy.
It really is a vindication of the forecasting model that we use here at the Trumpet, looking at Bible prophecy, and even when the facts look otherwise, sticking with those and just knowing that somehow, some way, at some point, it will play out the way that God said that it would. We thank you very much for that, Brent. Over now to Europe, critics in the European Union continue to say that this massive 27-nation project is unworkable. The latest of these is coming from Portugal, which is putting forward a plan to shrink the union. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Portugal wants a smaller European Union, and not just Portugal. France is backing this plan as well, and they're talking about a smaller EU or a two-speed EU, where you have a smaller core group of nations goes much further to integration, while the slower, more reluctant ones are allowed to go along at a slower pace. But the Portuguese leader, António Costa, he's talked about how variable geometrics are needed because of a real dichotomy or a real division within Europe. He's seeing that the Europe of 27 nations isn't working. And so he's going to push the idea next spring at a special summit in European leaders in Lisbon, which is where the last EU treaty was signed back in 2007. And again, France is going to be supporting them in that.
So what is motivating Portugal to put forward this plan?
So specifically, it gets back to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where Europe finally, after months of coronavirus, has gotten their coronavirus bailout package together, and then it got vetoed by Poland and Hungary. This is the big catalyst that has caused Portugal to say, well, this just isn't working. But that's just the latest in a long series of events. That's why they're saying, look, it's more fundamental. There are other nations that are looking at this and saying, well, you know, what kind of tricky procedural mechanisms can we do to get this budget through? Portugal, with France's backing, really, as taking, well, we're saying, well, we need to do more than just find a way just to wiggle this particular proposal through. We need to take a step back and redesign the whole European Union.
Now, this is something that we expect. It's 27 nations right now. The Bible says at some point it's going to be 10 kings.
That's right. And that expectation is very logical given this problem that we've seen repeatedly. And the Bible forecasts these 10 kings. Revelation chapter 17 talks about this overall power, this beast, which is an empire in biblical symbolism, being made up of 10 different kings, and they all give their power to this one overall empire. And so Herbert W. Armstrong has been forecasting a European Union. He even used those terms all the way back in 1945 and saying, well, this is how it would get together. And I think what is interesting about Portugal's proposal, it's exactly in line with that, but then Germany is against it, not because they're against this idea of shrinking it down. They just don't like who Portugal wants to include and wants to exclude. You know, they're fine with the idea of a smaller European Union. They're not fine with Portugal being the one that picks and chooses who goes into that. So we may well see this Portuguese initiative come to nothing. We may have to wait until it's Germany that's really solidly in the driving seat and they make sure they get to pick exactly who is in and who is out, that this really moves forwards. But a very clear indication that Europe is going in the direction that Bible prophecy said that it would go in.
Anywhere that you would send someone more interested in that prophecy?
Yes, we have our Trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Ongoing Unification Project. You can get that if you go to the Trends section. We have that right at the top of our website. And then under Europe, there's a section that says Europe becoming a 10-nation superpower. And that will tell you exactly why, you know, we expect 10 nations, why Revelation 17 applies to modern Europe.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Aristotle. Tolerance and apathy are the last virtues of a dying society. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.